have sailed. I have moved about this world of ours, and ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the tops in Spine Chillers.
And you are listening to Radio Masterpieces on Valley 103.1, serving Duval, Carnation, and Redmond Ridge.
When you were enjoying your own private life in a civilian suit, and you spent money on some baby doll, she had to be quite a beaut. But when you're a rookie at 21 per, for any old gal you will fall. When you're a civilian, it's one in a million, but when you're in camp, bless them all.
Bless them all, bless them all, the long and the short and the tall.
Bless all the blondies and all the brunettes, each lad is happy to take what he gets.
'Cause we're giving the eye to them all, the one that attract or appall.
Maud, Maggie, or Susie,
you can't be too choosy.
When you're in camp, bless them all. Bless them all, bless them all, the long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants, the sourpuss ones. Bless all the corporals and their dopey sons. 'Cause we're saying goodbye to them all as back to the barracks they crawl. No ice cream or cookies for flat-footed rookies, so cheer up, my lads, bless them all.
They say that in camp you can have a swell time. We've heard it all before. 5 in the morning, we're kicked out of bed to scrub up the barrack room floor. A private has really no privacy now. We're all behind the eight ball. No ice cream or cookies for flat-footed rookies. So cheer up, my lads, bless them all.
Bless them all, bless them all, the long and the short and the tall.
Bless the kind sergeant who tucks you in bed, then brings ice water to cool off your head.
That's a new one on me after all. It must be a dream I recall.
No ice cream or cookies for fat-footed rookies. So cheer up, my lads, bless them all. Bless them all,
bless them all,
bless them all. The long and the short and the tall. Bless all the sergeants, the sourpuss ones. Bless all the corporals and their dopey sons. 'Cause we're saying goodbye to them all as back to the barracks they crawl.
No ice cream or cookies,
not for flat-footed rookies. So
cheer up, my lads, bless them all. Heavyweight, underweight, big or small, when you're in camp, bless them all.
This is Bruce Kaplan welcoming you back to another episode of Radio Masterpieces. Boy, do we have two wonderful shows for you tonight. We have one from the Inner Sanctum series. The Inner Sanctum series was one of the most popular programs on the air in the 1940s. And then the man who did the Inner Sanctum series, who was the director, producer, was a man named Hyman Brown. And in the 1970s, he brought old-time radio back big time when he brought back the CBS Mystery Theater. Tonight, we're going to listen to an episode of Inner Sanctum and an episode of The Whistler. And The Whistler is really my favorite program of the era of the 1940s. It was about the most popular program on the West Coast for many, many years. If you have any questions for me, please don't hesitate to write to Bruce at RadioMasterpieces.com, and I'll try to get the kind of mysteries that you like to listen to, the kind of thrillers. Also, I want to wish everybody in my audience a most happy holiday season. I hope everything's going well. I hope you're having a great summer. Again, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to write to me, Bruce at RadioMasterpieces.com. Thank you so much for listening, and just have a fantastic week.
Thank you. Tonight's Inner Sanctum mystery, Catch a Killer, stars Larry Haynes in the role of Stitch with Barbara Weeks as Gale.
Tonight's drama is told under the byline of Stitch Thompson, a newspaper man as hard-boiled as a 10-minute egg. The way men get who make murder their business. He's in Joe's restaurant, staring restlessly at nothing. The way men do who are fed up with themselves.
10 years on the crime beat and your mind begins to crack a little. Like a punch-drunk fighter talking to himself. You've seen the sordid side of life and it's crept into your system. You forget more than you remember just to keep from going nuts. But there's one experience I do remember. Because it happened to me last. It began in court. A guy was being sentenced to death.
Marco Chase, you have been found guilty of murder by a jury of your peers. It is the sentence of this court that you be taken to the state penitentiary and kept there until the week of October 20th.
No! No!
It was a girl. A perky little brunette fainting dead away. A wife or a sister, maybe, or... just a woman hearing the bell tolled over a guy who was too young to die. It was a sister, as it turned out to be, a little while later when I ran into her again at Joe's restaurant, a newspaper man's hangout. Now, you better stop it, kid. You'll just get yourself sick. Marco, your husband?
My brother. He didn't do it. He didn't murder Mona Taylor.
It's a little late to go into pros and cons. Mona Taylor was his dancing partner, huh?
Yes, but that was all. He wasn't in love with her, and he didn't murder her. If Mona Taylor was murdered...
If? Well, wait a minute. They'd never have gotten a conviction without a corpus delicti.
They found her in the river, a body that was hardly anything. It had been weeks.
They identified the body.
But how? Teeth. Just a small dental crown and a dentist's testimony, so-called measurements. The measurements fit, but that could have been a coincidence.
Yeah, it could have been. The main gimmick was that dentist's testimony.
All horribly circumstantial.
90% of hanging evidence is circumstantial, kid.
Help him, Mr. Thompson, please.
Oh, you know me, huh?
Yes. You've succeeded where the police failed so many times.
You've been oversold on my reputation.
You won't help me?
I wouldn't know how. Sorry. I said no, but I took her red eyes away with me. Her red eyes were right in front of me a couple of days later. I was on an assignment at the city morgue. A local racketeer had been riddled with bullets and tossed into the streets. There was a woman beside me, a relative. She was there to identify the remains. I watched her look and I listened to her scream.
Mr. Thompson. I prayed for you to come.
There was a corpse in the city morgue just now, and a woman screaming. The way I saw it, the corpse was your brother Marco. The way I heard it, it was you screaming come October 20th.
Save Marco, please.
That's if he's really innocent.
He is.
Well, my hat's off to your technique, kid. You sure hopped me up with a sense of guilt, made me feel as if...
As if?
As if I'd be guilty of murder if your brother went to the chair an innocent man.
How will you help my brother? You have a plan?
No, I'll have to feel around blindly. I'll needle the cops into second-guessing. One big hint in the newspaper about how the evidence that convicted Marco was a little lightweight. That maybe there's more to the Mona Taylor murder than was told. It's only an arrow in the air, kid. Don't bank on a thing. The arrow landed right on Tom Ryder's sore spot. Tom Ryder was the county DA.
Have you lost your mind completely, Stitch? Seven stories on the Mona Taylor murder.
On the Marco Chase conviction.
A closed case.
Not until the evening of October 20th.
What makes you think he's an innocent man? He's been tried and judged.
I don't know exactly. Call it a hunch. Or, maybe it's his fifth sister's faith that sold me. I'm crazy, huh?
You're not kidding. Haven't you something interesting and current to write about?
Marco Chase is current and choice.
How far do you expect to go with this nonsense?
I shouldn't tip my hand, but I will. Right now, Marco's sister, Gail, is trying to persuade Mrs. Mary Taylor, that's the victim's mother, to petition for court permission to exhume the body of Mona Taylor.
Exhume the body of Mona Taylor?
That's if we can get the mother to agree.
But why?
Well, we not only think Marco Chase is innocent, but we also have an idea that the corpus delicti might not be Mona Taylor. The DA wasn't the only one. There was someone else really put out and determined to do something about it. About me, I mean. She made out with Mona Taylor's mother when my door buzzer phoned. There's a kid with a package.
Mr. Stitch Thompson?
Yeah, that's me.
Well, here's a package for you.
Who from?
Well, a man in the Owl drugstore said to bring it to you at 9 sharp.
9 sharp it is, thanks. It's just a package. A box and brown wrapping paper. I opened it. Who wouldn't open it? How suspicious can you get? I got the cover off and the room fell on me. There were bells way off somewhere. I was waking up to bells. I'd been asleep for 1,000 years like a mummy in a tomb. There were bandages all around my head.
Hello, Stitch.
Gail, where am I?
In a hospital. We've been here 3 days.
What happened?
A time bomb wrapped in a parcel was delivered to you.
Oh, yeah, I remember. At 9 sharp, it went off right on the button. How bad am I?
Cuts and burns. Who did it, Stitch?
Don't know. Someone who doesn't like what I'm up to. Someone who wants the case to stay like it is, closed. Oh, did you talk Mona Taylor's mother into it?
Yes. She agreed, finally, just this morning. She petitioned for court permission to exhume the body of her daughter.
On the day I was checked out of the hospital, we exhumed the alleged body of Mona Taylor and shipped it to a private laboratory.
Just what do you hope to accomplish out of this grisly business?
A detailed chart of the victim, Mr. D.A., as well as it can be constructed. All measurements, bone widths, body scars, if any, and so forth. The physiological story and the medical story, as good as we can get it.
And then what?
Then we compare it detail for detail with the chart we've gotten up on the known Mona Taylor. The idea is to see if the lady now in our laboratory and Mona Taylor are the same people.
But that's already been done thoroughly.
Yeah, I know. By the state, with your experts. This time, we're doing it for the defense, with our experts. It's all a little speculative, maybe. Just a way of showing we were really in earnest, really dead set on forcing official interest in action. But there was one immediate result.
Stitch!
Yeah?
Her teeth. The dental crown that the state used to prove she was actually Mona Taylor.
Yeah, but the one that dentist swore he'd made for her?
Yes.
So?
Mona Taylor was buried with her crown in her mouth. Her mother insisted she be buried like that. Remember?
Yeah. Yeah, the old lady did make an issue of it. What about that crown?
It's gone.
Mona Taylor was buried in it, Stitch, but now it's gone.
I beat the DA to the dentist whose positive identification of the dental bridge did so much to cinch the state's identification of the body.
But why come to me, Mr. Thompson?
I'm looking for a dentist. What are you so nervous about, Dr. Penner?
Well, I'm a nervous man.
Just nervous, huh?
Now, look, if you continue like this any further, I'll call the police.
Tell the police you've got my fingerprints on your face, lover boy. I said lover boy, but what do you bet you weren't that lucky? What do you bet you made very slow time with Mona Taylor?
Oh, that's absurd.
Your acting's lousy. Now, where is Mona Taylor?
Where is... Frank, are you insane? She was buried.
They buried a girl they called Mona Taylor mainly because you identified a dental job in her mouth. Strike out your testimony and the corpse was a practically unidentifiable somebody washed ashore after weeks in the river. I'm not just guessing or bluffing, Penner. We exhumed the body this morning and found the dental crown she was buried with missing.
Missing?
You're acting still lousy. Now talk.
I lied when I identified the crown.
Why?
Well, I was forced to. Someone kept telephoning threats to kill me if I didn't.
Who kept telephoning it?
I don't know. It was just a voice on the telephone. A hard, determined voice like yours. A voice I became afraid of. He said it was to both our advantages, his and mine, if the body was identified as Mona Taylor.
Why'd you go to the crazy risk of stealing the crown?
Well, your newspaper articles made me do it. Your demands that the body be exhumed and the case reopened. You see, I was afraid another dentist would turn up, the dentist who had really worked on Mona Taylor. You see, I never did any work on her.
Okay, Penner, get your hat.
My hat?
And take it off when you enter the DA's office. Tell him what you've told me. Tell him especially that his corpus delicti is probably not the real Mona Taylor. And tell him that you wanted to prevent exhumation of the body so desperately you tried to blow Stitch Thompson off the face of the earth. You did send that time bomb, didn't you?
Yes, I sent it. I must have been crazy.
I knew Marco was innocent.
Not so fast, Gail. Mona Taylor is still a missing dancer who might turn up dead. And the odds are top-heavy that she will turn up just like that.
Why are you so certain, Stitch?
The kind of girl Mona was. All meek and no hurt. She made men a career. Bet on it that way, kid. Mona Taylor is dead. We bet on it like that. With the mother's reluctant okay, we holed up in Mona's apartment that night to see if we could get a line on the men in her life from her letters and a stack of diaries. Get a line on one guy, especially. The guy who had put the heat on the dentist Penner in the first place and gotten him to perjure in court.
You were right about Mona. About her making a career of men.
Yeah, he undersold her. Men crawl through her diaries like ants.
She hated men. Men loved her, but she hated them.
Yeah.
She was no good, Stitch. If she's dead, I'm glad.
Oh, I get it. She did a good job on your brother Marco, too.
Not for my brother. I don't hate her just for that. I hate her for all the men who fall honestly in love. And for you, Stitch. I hate her for you, too.
For me?
Yes. I've watched you staring at her picture all night. She's beautiful, isn't she?
Yeah, she is.
But there are other beautiful women in the world.
Yeah, but not like... Now, look, you've got me mooning over a girl I don't even know.
I didn't do it, Stitch. It just happened to you. I watched you finger her trinkets before, and her gowns. The way your hands touched things Mona owned and wore.
How How do I touch them?
Tenderly. With a touch of love.
Kid, you're crazy.
Am I?
Sure you are. Sure, I can go for a girl like the next guy can. So what? I could go for Mona. I could go for you.
Can't you go for me?
Well, easier than for Mona. She's only a photograph on the bureau. You're alive, baby, right within reach.
Then reach, Stitch.
What?
Reach. Kiss me.
Are you kidding?
No. Kiss me.
Funny, but I can't.
You can't. In her room with her picture staring at you with Mona alive in the room.
You're trying to hoodoo me into believing I'm in love with a ghost, but the fact is you're jealous of a ghost.
I am jealous of her. It's insane, I know, but I am. I'm sorry, Stitch.
Oh, forget it. It's a kind of a spell in this room anyway. Let's get back to our work. We've got a lot of names here for the DA to investigate, the 100 men who are after Mona. If Ryder turns a miracle, he'll pull the one man out of the list. The one man who can lead the police to Mona.
But if one woman can lead the police to Mona?
One woman?
Yes, Stitch. One woman. Me.
You? I don't get it.
I know where Mona Taylor is buried. I visited my brother in the death house last night. Marco told me things.
Gail knew all right and showed me. We drove upstate New York into the Catskills and parked outside a big iron gate that had a sign over a main lodge reading Martinson's Bungalows for Rent, Hunting and Fishing. All right, now what?
There are scattered bungalows half mile up that footpath. We'll have to walk the rest of the way.
And Mona's up there somewhere?
Yes, where my brother left her the night she disappeared.
Mona was there, all right. Up where a natural lake had dried into marshland. I got on my hands and knees and turned my flashlight on her, but I couldn't see her. There was a burlap bag over her. Her last resting place was a broken culvert built into a dam that was no longer in use. But Mona was no longer in use. Your brother left to here, you said. What's the rest of it?
Marco rented a cabin up here for the season. He'd driven Mona up. They were to go over a new dance routine. Marco drove to the village to shop for groceries, provisions. He left Mona here, reading. When he got back, she was dead. Shot through the heart. Marco lost his head. He didn't notify the police. He hid her here.
Mm-hmm. Afraid he'd be the fall guy, huh?
Yes. Their names had been linked romantically. They'd fought publicly backstage in nightclubs.
Why didn't he open up about where the real Mona Taylor was during his trial?
He gambled on being acquitted. But in hiding Mona, he compromised himself hopelessly. I couldn't advise him. I discovered these things just last night when I visited him.
Whoever sneaked up here to shoot Mona came up on foot. Parked his car at that big gate down there and came up on foot.
He had to.
This was during the daytime, you said. The stores were open for your brother to do his shopping.
It was between noon and 2 p.m. on July 18th.
And that name down there where we parked, Martinson. Who is Martinson?
Flora Martinson, the widow. She manages the lodge and rents out the bungalows.
Let's go have a talk with her.
A strange car parked out there on that day, July 18th. It was at 1 o'clock. I took the license number down, and it's right here in my day book.
I phoned the license number to District Attorney Ryder. But before dropping in on him to see who he'd nailed, I took Gail to Joe's restaurant. And she was red-eyed again like the day I met her. All right. All right, now what's watering your eyes, kid?
Nothing special. I've always cried. Since I was a child, I've cried.
Well, what for? Or is it for what?
For everything and everybody. For the mess people make out of their lives. For my brother. For all the men who fall in love with all the Mona. I cry for you too, Stitch.
For a wreck who blanks out here at Joe's 7 nights a week, huh?
For a great newspaper man who could have been a wonderful guy.
Thanks for the tears, baby. You ever cry for yourself?
I am, now. I'm crying for a girl who could have fallen in love with a guy who could have been a wonderful guy.
Thanks again, baby.
Stitch, where are you going?
To see what the DA's come up with. Hiya, DA.
Hello, Stitch. Sit down. I checked auto license 6Y410. I wired the state capitol on your tip. Here's what they wired back. Green coupe, 1946. The owner's vital statistics are age, 36, height, 5'11", weight, 175 pounds. Eyes, blue. You sure he was the man who murdered Mona Taylor?
Yeah, I'm sure. What's his name and address?
He lives at 625 10th Street. His name is Stitch Thompson. Why'd you come forward like this now? This late?
I didn't. A brunette named Gail pushed me forward. She knew I was the guy who murdered Mona. She also knew I was a punch-drunk reporter who'd blanked out. So she started a campaign to start me remembering. You know, she did it to save her brother. But a funny thing happened to her. She's in Joe's right now, crying her eyes out for me.
Devious course through the back and side streets of the town, skirting the main road that led to the small suburb. At the wheel, Eve Traherne sat rigid, her face tense, expressionless, her jaw set, her eyes riveted on the road ahead of her. The white nurse's uniform she wore seemed entirely out of character. The watch she glanced at as she wheeled the car around a curve, a dazzling blob of diamonds, was not a nurse's watch. Indeed, Eve Traherne was not a nurse. Yet she was on her way to perform a nurse's duties at the bedside of an ailing woman. And there was murder in her heart. Strange, really, that the end would be like this, when the beginning was so different. That day, so long ago, in the office of Gordon Dietrich, when Eve McKay first met Philip Traherne.
Eve, I'd like to have you meet Philip. Philip Traherne, Eve McKay.
How do you do, Mr. Traherne?
Eve McKay, the author of Fire and Ice?
Oh, you've read my book.
Philip checks through all my historical novels. Eve is a history professor at Litchfield. We were roommates there years ago.
Really? Tell me, Professor, did you like Fire and Ice?
There were some flagrant historical discrepancies in it, Miss McKay.
I meant the writing.
Well, to tell you the truth, Miss McKay, I'm afraid I found some of your characters a bit hard to believe.
Flame Winthrop, for example.
Yes. Perhaps women like Flame do exist, and I just don't know about them. After all, I guess I'm just an old college pedant with ink in my veins.
Yes, perhaps you are, Professor.
Well, I hope I haven't offended you. Gordon, tell her I mean well.
Oh, Eve knows that, I'm sure.
As a matter of fact, Professor, I was going to ask for your help. I have a first draft, a novel on the Renaissance. It's almost finished. I'd like for you to look at it before I go any further. I wouldn't want any more flagrant historical discrepancies. You know.
Well, I'd be very glad to.
Fine. I just live a few blocks from here.
Just remember that Philip lives in Litchfield. Those trains don't run all night.
Why, Gordon, it shouldn't take an hour. And I'll drive him to the station myself. Come along, Professor.
simple beginning, isn't it, Eve? Yet for some unexplainable reason, you feel a challenge to knock this quiet, tweedy man out of his ivory tower. To prove to him that women like Flame Winthrop and you, Eve, do exist. And when he leaves that night, just in time to catch the last train to Litchfield, you know he'll be back. And he does come back. The next week and the next, doesn't he? Always with some flimsy excuse. Your little game is going well. He's falling in love with you, isn't he? But he won't face it himself. So one night, seated before the fire, you force him to admit it.
Been a wonderful evening, Phil.
All our evenings were wonderful. I mean, you're a very stimulating person to be with, Eve. I've never known anyone who...
Phil, don't.
Don't what?
Don't say anymore. I'm going to leave here, Phil.
But why, Eve?
You know why.
Eve.
I'm in love with you and you're married. I'm not the kind of woman who'll take half a loaf.
No, certainly not.
So there's no other out for me, is there?
I suppose it would be best for us both if you leave.
Kiss me goodbye, Phil.
I don't think it's wise.
Please kiss me, Phil.
Oh, Eve, I can't let you go now. You know I can't let you go.
What? There's no other way, darling. Is there?
Yes, Eve. There is one other way.
Huh?
I'll ask Ethel for a divorce.
Strange, isn't it, Eve? You should feel triumphant. Your little game of knocking Philip Traherne out of his ivory tower has worked perfectly. Yes, Eve, you've trapped him, just as you planned to do. But after he leaves you that night, you realize for the first time you've trapped yourself, too.
No. I won't be. But I am. I'm in love with him. Helplessly. In love with him.
Yes, Eve, that was the beginning. Your first chance meeting with Philip. Your determination, because of his patronizing attitude towards your book, to prove to him that you could interest him as a woman, if not as an author. And it worked out, didn't it, Eve? Except that in the process of making him fall in love with you, you've fallen in love with Philip, too. His divorce from Ethel was a mere formality after that. And now you're Mrs. Philip Traherne, wife of a history professor at Litchfield. Not quite the role you'd intended for yourself. But as you approach the door of his home in the little college town for the first time, you determine to make Litchfield, as well as Philip, forget that Ethel Traherne ever existed.
Well, welcome home, Professor Traherne.
Thank you, Mrs. Welch. It's good to be back. This is Mrs. Traherne.
Hello, Mrs. Welch.
Good afternoon, ma'am.
Yes, it's certainly fine to be back. Well, Lady Macbeth. And how are you, huh?
Philip, you didn't tell me you had a cat.
Oh, didn't I? Well, I have. Just about the most beautiful tortoiseshell cat I've ever seen.
Oh, why Lady Macbeth?
Mrs. Traherne named her that because it was always washing those orange marks on her paws. How very clever. Come here, lady. Come on. I'd like to pet you.
Oh, you... Eve, I'm sorry. I should have told you she's nervous around strangers.
Cats aren't supposed to be trustworthy. But they got their loyalty.
Really? You know, she'd better get used to me, Mrs. Wilkes. Because I'll be running this house for a long time. A long time.
And that's your introduction to Litchfield, Eve. You've been in town less than 5 minutes, and you've already alienated Philip's housekeeper and his precious cat, Lady Macbeth. In that short time, too, you've sensed that you have a formidable threat in Ethel, Philip's first wife. And in the weeks that follow, you're made to realize that you don't belong in Litchfield. You're not accepted. And most of all, that you'll never replace Ethel in Litchfield's affection.
President Conway's residence.
May I speak with Mrs. Conway, please?
Who's calling, please?
This is Eve Traherne. Professor Traherne's wife.
One moment, please. Hello, Mrs. Traherne?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Mrs. Conway is out.
I see. Do you know when to expect her?
I'm sorry. I don't know. I really have no idea.
I see. Thanks for nothing.
So, do you mind if I share your table?
Of course not. Sit down.
Thanks so much. I'm Della.
You're Professor Hutchins' daughter. I know.
Oh, really? Are you from the college?
I'm Professor Traherne's wife.
You're Eve... I mean...
Yes, I know what you mean.
Jeepers, look at that clock. I had no idea it was so late. I'm afraid I won't have time to eat. It's been nice meeting you, Mr. Traherne. Goodbye.
It's all around you, isn't it, Eve? The symbol of your rejection. You won't let yourself lose, not to Litchfield, and most of all, not to Ethel. The day your novel on the Renaissance appears in the bookstore, you go down to watch how the sales are going. You haven't been there long when you overhear a conversation in front of the display on your book.
Lady of the Renaissance. Brother, where do those jacket artists get their models?
You know who the author is, don't you? Professor Traherne's wife.
Yeah, I know, poor guy. He was all set for that appointment, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was unofficial, of course, but everyone knew he was supposed to be named the new dean of history.
Huh?
But now, I wonder if he feels she's really worth it.
It's a shock, isn't it, Eve? You knew nothing of the prospective deanship for Philip. Later that same afternoon, you're at home considering a course of action to take. When Gordon Dietrich, your publisher, comes by to call.
Oh, Gordon, how perfectly wonderful to see you.
This is a business call, Eve. I can't stay very long. I brought you the reports of the advance sale on your book. Looks as if it's going well.
Well, that's good. Although I must say it doesn't seem to please my publisher very much.
I don't like to mix my professional life with my personal life, but...
Gordon, I don't believe I understand.
Philip is my friend, Eve. So is Ethel. I'd like them married to each other. You had no right to break it up, deliberately as you did.
Philip didn't seem to mind. And after all, it is our affair.
That's right, it is, entirely. Just the same, I'd rather you found another publisher for any future work you may do.
Very well, I will. If that's the way you feel about it.
Gordon's reaction enrages you, doesn't it, Eve? Because it makes your opposition so complete. It makes you even more determined that Philip shall have that deanship. Not in spite of you, but because of you. Shortly after Gordon leaves, you hit on a plan. That same afternoon, you go into the city. A hurried overnight trip about the book, you tell Philip. Once there, using your ingenuity and your money in the right places, you gather your weapons. And late the next afternoon, armed with the ammunition to satisfy the one weak spot of President Conway of the college, you call at his office.
My uncle was such a strange man, President Conway. Several of the first editions he left me turned out to be fakes. I'm afraid it takes an expert like yourself to distinguish between them.
It's amazing. Amazing, Mrs. Traherne. Every one of these books is genuine. Thackeray, Dickens, Jonathan Swift, and all in excellent condition. I can't say how I envy you.
I only wish I could appreciate them as you do. I'm afraid they're just books to me.
Just books. Why, Mrs. Traherne, if I were a man of means, I'd give you $5,000 for them right now.
Well, then I'd appreciate it if you'd simply accept them.
Oh, no, I couldn't.
Please, it would mean so much to me to know someone had them who really appreciated them. I'd consider it a favor, Dr. Conway.
Oh, but surely Philip would appreciate them as much as I do.
Oh, no, not nearly so much. Philip has only two interests, history and his job. There is whole life. As far as fiction is concerned, first or tenth editions mean absolutely nothing to him. Dr. Conway,
I insist that you accept these.
Mrs. Treherne, you're too kind. I mean, I can't say...
Don't say anything. Just enjoy them. This is between you and me, Dr. Conway. No one need ever know where they came from.
Eve, where are you?
Here, dear.
It happened, Eve. The letter just came.
What letter, Philip?
From the Board of Regents, Eve. They've made me the new Dean of History.
Oh, Philip, that's wonderful. Oh, I'm so proud, darling.
I know who's behind this appointment, too. President Conway. I'd never have gotten it without his recommendation.
You've worked wonders, haven't you, Eve? And you're sure that when Philip is installed as Dean of History, your position in Litchfield will be guaranteed, and you need fear nothing more from Ethel. The day of Philip's installation finally comes, and you're ready for it. And at mid-afternoon, you're standing before the bedroom mirror, admiring your gown, when there's a tap on your door.
Yes, what is it?
Mrs. Conway is downstairs to see you, ma'am.
The president's what?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, how the mighty have fallen. Mrs. Wilkes, I've told you never to let that cat in my room. Get her out of here.
Yes, ma'am. Come on, Lady Macbeth.
Get out of here, you...
Come on, Lady Macbeth. I was to take the rest of the day off, ma'am. Will you be coming down?
When I'm ready. You may leave for this day, Mrs. Wilkes. Tell Mrs. Conway I'll see her in 10 minutes. Mrs. Conway, how nice to see you. I'm sorry we haven't met sooner, but now that Philip is to be dean, I imagine we'll see a great deal of one another.
I should doubt that very much, Mrs. Treherne. I beg your pardon. I came here today only to return some property of yours. These three books, Mrs. Treherne. First editions of Thackeray, Dickens, and Swift.
Oh, yes. Well, you see, my uncle...
My husband subscribes to a rare book journal. They list the sales of all important first editions.
You bought these through Rosenbach 10 days ago.
I told your husband this was just between him and me.
I think you should know, Mrs. Treherne, that my husband cast his vote for Philip after he knew about this attempted bribery.
Then Philip won't lose his appointment.
No. My husband voted for Philip for 2 reasons. One, because Philip deserves the deanship. He's right for the job. And 2, Mrs. Treherne, because Ethel is a very dear friend of ours, and she pleaded that Philip's divorce not affect our decision.
Ethel.
You have her to thank for the appointment, Mrs. Treherne. And let me tell you something. You will never replace Ethel. Not in the college's affection, or in Philip's.
I'm sure you feel you can speak for Litchfield, Mrs. Conway. But I know my husband. You may not like it, but Philip is in love with me.
Yes, Eve, you're sure of Philip, aren't you? Furious as you are with Mrs. Conway, it doesn't shake your faith in Philip's love for you. You walk upstairs to your room. You've got to think. But as you reach the door, you see something that enrages you still further.
My dress! Get off there, Lady Macbeth. Get off my dress, you little demon!
What on earth?
Your cat! Your precious Lady Macbeth! She's ripped my dress! I'll kill her! That cat hates me. Like everyone here hates me. I want her out of my house right now, this instant. Have her destroyed. Take her to the vet right now.
Control yourself. You shouldn't have left the dress on the bed.
This cat hates me, I tell you, and I hate her. I want her destroyed. I want her killed.
All right, Eve, that's enough. I'll see you at 7 this evening. I've got to call on President Conway now.
Take that cat with you to the vet, Philip.
All right, Eve. I'll take her. She'll never bother you again.
You watch him pick up the cat and walk out of the room and down the stairs. You glance at your watch. Philip said he'd see you at 7. It's nearly 5 now. The dress will have to be repaired in time to wear it to Philip's installation dinner. And there's just a chance you can get your dressmaker to fix it for you. You cross the room, pick up the phone to call her.
I wish you'd
You're surprised to find the line in use. It's Philip talking on the downstairs extension. Philip talking to Ethel.
Well, Ethel, I had no idea you were ill. Why didn't you let me know?
I'm not very ill. I'll be all right in a few days. I'm so glad you called. I'm so proud of you. This is the day you've worked toward for 15 years.
You worked too, Ethel. You always said I'd be dean someday, and... Oh, Ethel, I wish...
Well, now, Philip, just you give a good speech at the dinner tonight. Don't forget it the way you used to.
Ethel, are you all right?
I think I'd better hang up now, Philip. I do feel rather weak.
Oh, my dear, can I...
I'll be all right, Philip, really. Don't worry. And remember, I am proud of you.
You hang up quickly, Eve. Philip's concern over Ethel, his desire to share his hour of triumph with her. You wonder, don't you, if Mrs. Conway was right, that you'd never replace Ethel in Philip's affection. You expect to hear the door slam, indicating that Philip has left the house. But when you pick up the phone again...
I tell you, Doc, I don't like to think of Ethel out there all alone. I want a nurse for her, Doc. Full time.
Oh, that can run into a lot of money, Phil.
I want a nurse for her. I can't stand to think of her way out there in the suburbs all alone at a time like this.
All right, Phil. I'll call the nursing home if it'll ease your mind.
Forgive me, Doc. I don't mean to sound upset. It's just that Ethel... Well,
I understand, Phil. There are still ties between you and Ethel. There always will be.
You grip the phone till your knuckles are white. For now you know that what Mrs. Conway said is true. Ethel will always stand between you and Philip as long as she lives. As long as she lives, Eve. You step to the bedroom window, watch Philip leave the house carrying Lady Macbeth in the crook of his arm. Then you see him hail a passing taxi and ride off. You're glad he's leaving you the convertible, the family car. For suddenly you see a solution. Pick up the phone and dial a number.
Litchfield Nursing Home.
Oh, hello. This is Dr. Starr's assistant. The doctor just phoned you, I believe, about sending a nurse out to Mrs. Ethel Treherne.
That's right, he did.
Well, the doctor asked me to cancel that call. You see, I know Ethel, that is, Mrs. Treherne, quite well. I'm going to take care of her myself.
Well, Eve, you have taken care of Ethel, haven't you? You've killed her. Philip belongs to you now, doesn't he? As you drive back into Litchfield from Ethel's, you check your watch, and you know Philip isn't due home for some time. So you take the long way home. It's a much longer road, Eve, but you don't want to be seen. You drive a mile or so, stop and slip off the nurse's uniform you wore over your dress, hurriedly stuff it into the glove compartment. You're sure you have nothing to worry about. Mrs. Wilkes is not at home. She's been gone for hours. And no one need ever know that you left the house this afternoon. As you turn into the driveway of your home, you stop the car at the side entrance of the house.
Hello, Eve.
Oh, Gordon. Well, what are you doing here?
I was waiting for Phil. He asked me to come up for his installation as dean.
I see.
I've been waiting here for an hour. Maybe I misunderstood Phil about the time.
You've been here an hour.
Well, that's right. Well, look.
But,
well, there's Phil getting out of that taxi. Hey, Phil.
Oh, Gordon.
Eve? Oh, Phil. What's wrong? It's Ethel. She's dead.
Dead?
Oh, Phil. Oh, Philip, I'm so sorry.
I've just come from there. Looks like an accident. How did it happen, Phil?
Apparently, she smothered to death. Her face was turned into the pillow. She must have been sleeping awfully hard to have smothered that way. Police say she may have taken sleeping pills.
But That sounds reasonable.
No, but it isn't. No, no. Ethel never took them. Never in her life. Dr. Starr says he never prescribed any. No, I'm not satisfied with this accidental thing. The police aren't either.
Was she alone, Phil? Could anyone have come in?
That's it. If we could only prove someone else had been there, we'd know it was no accident. No one saw anyone enter or leave.
But why would anyone think Ethel was murdered?
No one said she was.
Yet?
Well, I know, but...
When did it happen, Phil?
Well, it had to be within the last hour or so. I talked with Ethel on the phone about an hour ago. Half ago.
Where were you for the last couple of hours, Eve?
Gordon.
I was here when you drove in, Eve. Where had you been?
Philip, are you going to let him talk to me this way, practically accusing
me? I don't like that
me?
Kind of talk, Gordon. I won't have it.
But... That's Lady Macbeth. Philip, I thought you took her to the vets this afternoon.
No, Eve, I didn't. I don't know how she got back
here. She just jumped out of the convertible. I saw her.
What's that got to do with it?
Eve. You just drove that car in here.
You were at Ethel's, Eve. You had to be at Ethel's at the time she died.
Philip, darling!
That's the only place Lady Macbeth could have climbed into the convertible.
Darling, you don't know what you're
saying. I'm sorry, but I do, Eve. You see, I couldn't bear to have that cat destroyed. I had to find some place where Lady Macbeth would be happy, cared for. So after I left here this afternoon, I took her to Ethel's.
Was missing, 2 hours overdue. One of our planes was missing with all its gallant crew. The radio sets were humming, they waited for a word. Then a voice broke through the humming, and this is what they heard. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on. We're coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show! Boy, what a fight! Say we really hit our target for tonight. How we sing as we limp through the air. Look below, there's our field over there. With our full crew aboard and our trust in the Lord, we're coming home on a wing and a prayer.
And ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the tops in Spine Chillers.
And you are listening to Radio Masterpieces on Valley 103.1, serving Duval, Carnation, and Redmond Ridge. The door is slowly closing for Radio Masterpieces, but be sure and tune in again next week from 9 to 10 p.m. to listen to more wonderful mysteries from the 1940s and 50s. This is Bruce Kaplan signing off. Radio Masterpieces is a Seattle Miracle Incorporated production.